Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, welcome to the Horse Hour podcast. We're at the National Equine Forum. It's the 28th forum this year, hearing from experts. And right now, my guest is David Rendell, and he's going to be talking about worm resistance and why we need to take charge of worm control. We're at the National Equine Forum today, and you'll be hearing from guests such as Zach Banham-Hurd, who's the Behavioural Insights team, Kirsty, RSPCA inspector, and my guest right now is David Rendell. He's a council member of the British Equine Veterinary Association and also a clinician at the University of Bristol. How are you, David?
Yeah, very good, thank you. Yeah, very good.
Well, I think out of your accolades, my favourite thing is that you've been a guest on the podcast before, so welcome back.
That was the highlight, so it's nice to be asked back. Thank you very much.
Today, you're doing a talk at the forum, which is great, and you're talking about worms and parasites. It's a bit of quite a big word for it that I can't even say. How would you describe it?
So anthelmintic resistance, which is a long word. That helminths are worms, posh word for worms, and anthelmintics are the drugs that we use to treat worms.
Oh, okay. And so what's your talk about today?
So it's about the problems that we face, which are under-recognised with resistance to these treatments for worms. So we've been using drugs to get rid of worms in horses since the 1960s. Because we keep horses in quite an intensive situation now. So they spread parasites more quickly than they would in the wild. So we need drugs to prevent them from getting diseases such as colic and weight loss. So we've been using these drugs for 50 plus years. And because we've been using them very frequently, the worms who are smarter than us have worked out how to evade those drugs. So by process of natural selection, those that are able to survive the drugs continue to breed, and then all the offspring are then resistant to those drugs. So we're now in a position where we've got parasites that we can't treat. And that obviously causes us a lot of problems and is going to cause us far greater problems in the future.
So what sort of damage can worms do to the horse?
It depends exactly which kind of worms. We've got two that cause us real problems. We've got ascarids, which are a problem in foals, and they block the intestine in foals and weanlings and cause them to colic and potentially to die. And then in older horses, we get more problems with another kind of roundworm, cyathostomins, which are small roundworms, small redworms. People call them lots of different things, which is a bit confusing. But they're smaller parasites that affect the large intestine in very large numbers. And they will cause damage to the gut lining. So the horses lose weight. They can become dull, can become colicky. They lose protein, so they get lots of swellings and accumulation of fluid under their abdomen. And sadly, they get diarrhea. And sadly, that too is also potentially fatal.
So if you had a horse that had either of those worm burdens, how would you expect to treat that?
Yeah. So that's the nub of the issue, really, is the way we used to treat worms was to dose them with an anthelmintic at a period around the year. So typically around four times a year. In young stock, people would do it more regularly. And we did it without a great deal of thought, to be honest. We were obsessed with preventing disease in individual animals and trying to eliminate those parasites. But we've been unsuccessful in eliminating the parasites. And what we've inadvertently done is just taught, for want of a better word, all of those worms how to survive the wormer, such that we're now in a position that strategy is not sustainable. And also we've got to be a bit more canny about working out which drugs are effective on which different properties. So what we try and do now is only treat them in accordance with clinical need. So if the horse has a very high burden of parasites and we're worried about that individual horse developing disease, then we would choose a wormer accordingly. Well, that's what we would like to happen. But the problem and the crux of my talk today is the fact that that isn't happening in the, with the majority of horse owners, not the majority of equestrian properties, and people are still worming far too frequently, which is just storing up problems for the future.
I think we've got a middle of this, the kind of owners are stuck between a rock and a hard place, because the worm programs are very much led, I found, by the livery yards. So whichever livery yard I've been on, it's been the owner that's dictated what worm program they're on. So I, for example, as a livery yard owner, have taken the worm counts. So we worm count every 3 months. But interestingly, I was told to worm in March and September for encysted redworm and for tapeworm. And now, after talking to you, I'm thinking, well, maybe that's not right either. Maybe I should be doing the testing for that instead and the counts.
So, yeah, and I think this is a potential source of difficulty, in that the advice is often perceived to be different from different people, even if most of us are singing from the same hymn sheet. And there are subtle differences in how we would approach different properties depending on their management, the ages of horses. So I would want to go into a bit more detail about what is going on your property before deciding whether those recommendations are right or wrong. And the important thing, though, is to reduce the use of wormers as much as we possibly can. And if we can do that through more testing, and we now have more and more testing available, then we absolutely should do that. There's a perception among owners that that can cost more money. That often isn't the case. And in the long term, actually, it will save the money, because they will be using a lot less wormer. But they need to engage with an expert, preferably a veterinary surgeon, and go through the management on their property and come up with a system that works best for them, that continues to protect the horses on the property but reduces the use of wormer to an absolute minimum and encourages diagnostics. So typically, in terms of diagnostics, we would be doing worm egg counts like you say you're doing, but typically focusing them through the grazing season from when it starts to warm up, so February, March, through into October, November. And there used to be a school of thought that the minimum we should give would be wormers twice a year, so spring and autumn. My view is that that still is too much. If we're using diagnostics appropriately, we now have really good diagnostics. In addition to the fecal tests, we have blood tests as well that we can use to look for roundworms and for tapeworms. If we're using all those things properly, we can further reduce wormer use potentially to zero or very close to zero in adult horses.
That's interesting, because again, I presumed, and I think a lot of this is hearsay and learning from what other people do, which is why I'm grateful that we get to speak to you, someone who actually knows what they're talking about. The question is, I presumed we're looking for a zero count, but I've heard of people having counts of 200 and not having to worm for that. So what are the levels, you know, should we expect a zero, yeah, or does it matter if there's a few? Because whatever we say, David, it's horrible to have worms. I know, because I've had horses that have had them, they've arrived with them. I've had horses that have been bought and come with worms. I've had horses that have moved on the yard with worms. And it's a really horrible thing to manage. But equally, it's also really embarrassing. And we shouldn't be embarrassed about it. But I guess it's understanding what's okay, what's normal, and learning how to deal with it and managing it properly.
So you highlight a number of problems. We need to absolutely change that perception that worms are bad and horrible. That worms are there. We just accept it. Horses have always had worms. We will never eliminate them. So they're always going to be there. So the key is to just keep them at a safe level that's not putting our horses at risk. So we need to get over this stigma that we have to try and eliminate worms. It's just not going to happen. And actually, we want a population of worms that are sensitive to the drugs that we're using, rather than having a population that are resistant. So the presence of sensitive worms is actually a good thing, because we've then got worms that are breeding in the environment that aren't concentrating the number of resistance genes. So much better to have a population of susceptible, treatable worms than a population of resistant worms. So yeah, we need to accept that horses have always had them and always will have them. We just need to keep them at a safe level. And primarily that's through management, things like collecting feces, maintaining sensible stocking densities. And then when we need it, we can use drugs to try and reduce the numbers to a safe level. But in terms of worm egg counts, absolutely, a worm egg count of 200, 250 is fine up to that level. That's the normal cutoff that most people will use. Some people, and I think we're going to have to accept this is going to become the norm as we find it harder and harder to kill these worms. Some people will look at counts up into the high hundreds, and there are some feral populations that are quite healthy where they'll be shedding egg counts into the thousands. So the 200, 250 limit is extremely conservative. But even using that level, we know from a number of studies that have been done that if we use that level of cutoff, rather than just treating every horse on a property, we will reduce the amount of worm that's used by about 80%, which is obviously a massive reduction, which is good for everybody.
And I guess we've got to take into consideration what we're doing as well as the worming. So poo picking the fields, where do you put the manure, making sure that any worms can't go back into the pasture so that horses can eat them again. The size, I'm guessing the size of the area that they're grazing, you know, are they grazing around their manure all the time? Are they going to eat the worms again once they've shed them? So there's quite a lot to take into account, isn't there?
Yeah, there is quite a lot. And I think that does cause some confusion, and sometimes horse owners switch off because it does appear complicated. But actually, the key messages are pretty simple. And you've just highlighted common sense things that drastically reduce the amount of wormer that needs to be used. But yeah, management is the key.
Yeah, so the ultimate goal then is that nobody will be worming unless we really, really, really have to. I know that with some wormers, you can count them through their manure. So you just take a little parcel, pop it in a bag, send it to your vet or send it to someone like Westgate Labs. You know, they post it. It's so easy now. They do a postal service. You can post it and within a few days, mm-hmm. you can get the results back. But how do you do the encysted redworm, which takes, 6 months for that to come through, and the tapeworm?
Okay, so the encysted redworm won't necessarily take that long to insist. We test for that with, there's a new blood test that's been available the last 12 months. So that gives us a level of antibodies that the horse is raising to that parasite. So we've got an indication from that antibody level how many of those parasites are there. So we can use that as a guide to treatment in addition to worm egg counts. And similarly, the tapeworm test is either a blood or a saliva test. And again, that's looking at antibody levels, and we can use those antibody levels to guide what level of parasites there are there. So if we've got a very low level of antibodies and we've got a low level of parasites, then we don't necessarily need to be treating either for encysted redworms or for tapeworms.
Amazing. So do you think we should be testing for that every year? Should every horse have a blood test for encysted redworm and a saliva test for tapeworm every year?
I think initially, yes, until you've got a good handle on the property. I'm reluctant to get sort of drawn into specific recommendations because it does depend on the nature of the property, the management of the property, the age of horses that are being kept. And most of what we're saying applies to adult horses. Foals are slightly different because they're more susceptible. As a rule of thumb, that is about right. Over time, potentially, we could reduce the amount of diagnostics we were doing if we were confident that the property was being managed well and there wasn't a high burden of parasites, which obviously over time helps to further reduce cost. The blood and the saliva tests are fantastic, but for some people, they're possibly even the next step down the line. What we really need to do as a first step is get everybody using fecal tests, worm egg counts through the summer, and not routinely worming through the grazing season. So if we could move everybody over to using fecal tests through the summer, we could reduce our wormer use by about 80%. If people are then prepared to do the blood test as well, and we can reduce it even further, then that would be fantastic. But anyone that isn't using fecal tests through the summer and is just routinely dosing according to the calendar really needs to stop, because they are storing up problems for themselves and their property in the future.
And where does pinworm come in? Because that's only something I heard recently last year for the first time.
Yeah, so pinworm is a more of a frustration for owners than it is for us as vets or clinicians. It's frustrating, it's irritating, but it's not life-threatening like these other parasites. So it's become more of a problem for people, again, probably because the parasites are becoming resistant, because we've been using so much wormer for so long that pinworms have also modified genetically and can now evade the wormers that we use. And as a result, the wormers we're using aren't killing them. So adult pinworms live in the rectum, and then they come out and they lay eggs around the horse's perineal region, so around its anus. And then those eggs are in a mucousy gel that the parasite secretes, and they're really itchy. So they cause horses to itch, but they don't cause any more serious disease than that. And that's not to trivialise it, because some horses can get quite sore with rubbing. But compared to what we were talking about with cystomins and ascarids, pinworm is an inconvenience rather than something that's fatal. To be honest, we don't have great ways of treating multi-resistant oxyuris. So that is a lesson for the future. We can't get rid of pinworms, and that causes a bit of bottom itching. It won't be long before we can't get rid of these other parasites, which cause colic, diarrhea and death.
It's horrible. Well, thank you very much. How did you come up with these? How did you guys find out that we were becoming resistant to wormers? Is it scientific testing, or do you do surveys? Like, how do you find out this stuff?
Well, every owner should be looking every year on their property in an ideal world. And again, that's a message that needs to come across because people just don't know that. So it's very simple. We check worm egg counts, we give a wormer, and then we check worm egg counts again 2 weeks later, and we see if those wormers are effectively reducing the number of worm eggs. So every owner can do that and should do that, because just about every owner has a degree of resistance on their property to at least one class of wormer. So if they can establish what they've got resistance to, then they can make more rational decisions about how to maintain the efficacy or the effectiveness of the wormers that we've got left. We've always been got out of jail in the past by having a new class of wormer coming through to which nothing was resistant, but there are no new classes on the horizon. So we don't have a get out of jail card anymore.
It's hard to know, David, where we can find the best information without being marketed to. So, you know, it's like when you look for feeds, the feed company is always going to sell their products first. It's confusing enough to know what wormers to go for, you know, because there's so many different wormers on the market. One of the things I was told previously was it's okay, you can just use a different make of wormer. So year one, you use Equest and Pramox. Year two, you use something else. Year three, you use Stronged P, and that can prevent the resistance. But from what you're saying is that no, we need to stop the wormers completely and use the worm counts, because they're getting resistant to everything. So where can we go then to find the most up-to-date information that's factual?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it is tricky. There are resources out there, and you're absolutely right to be skeptical, because a lot of the information you will get has a slight commercial slant to it. And the companies that are manufacturing and selling wormers are doing a much better job of talking about targeted treatment. However, they still do have to maintain sales of dewormers. So there's always an element of compromise. And I think most vets would like to see dewormers used a lot less frequently than most of those programs would advocate. So I would say the best course of action is to speak to the vet that looks after your yard, because they will have a good understanding of the management on your yard, and they will be able to tailor a system that is going to work for you and minimize the amount of dewormer that you can use. I think it's a lot of owners think they have quite a bit of knowledge about worming, but it is a phenomenally complicated subject if you really get into it. You look at the number of different parasites, you look at the number of different drugs, the number of different brands within each drug class, and it really is impossible, unless it's something you're thinking about and talking about a lot of the time, to really be across it. So yeah, I would really strongly urge people to speak to their vets about a program that's going to work for their yard.
David Rendell, thank you very much. We can watch your talk at the National Equine Forum if we head to their website, nationalequineforum.com. And if you're listening to this later, then don't worry, you can replay David's talk on YouTube. David, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Thanks so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. You can hear more podcasts from the National Equine Forum at their website, nationalequineforum.com. I speak to Abigail Turnbull from Richmond Equestrian Centre, who talks about how they survived strangles. I talk to Zach from the Behavioural Insights team on how we can change behaviour in the industry. And you can see the live streams of every guest speaker at the National Equine Forum website. I'll speak to you soon.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.